There's still plenty of hype going on about things that AI can do. And I also think there's underestimations by a fair number of people, particularly senior leaders, that they've heard about the hype and they're worried about it. And they've seen many deployments that have failed for a variety of reasons. And so they're not as willing to place large-term investments. And this could place some of these firms at risk because they're not going to be on the leading edge.
Hello and welcome to season 2 of Where AI Works, conversations and the intersection of AI and industry, brought to you by Wharton in collaboration with Accenture. My name is Sergey Netesin. I'm a professor of operations, information and decisions at the Wharton School, and I'm also senior vice dean for innovation and global initiatives. It is my great pleasure to be your host for this season of the podcast as we tackle the big questions shaping AI's role in the world of business today and into the future. It's our goal to cut through the noise and to deliver actionable insights for business leaders by combining cutting-edge research with real-world case studies. Things are changing fast, so without further ado, let's dive in.
We're also monetizing AI in a variety of different ways.
If you want to think big picture and you want to think AI and that trend that has really been the key driver of technology, Still talking about ways in which they can monetize AI.
Clearly, there are massive applications and demand for AI out there. You then start to have to focus a lot more on the monetization.
For this season of podcast, I'm going to focus primarily on business models and monetization of AI. After all, there are a lot of AI-powered technologies and solutions in the market, but if a big company wants to offer AI capabilities to its customers, it had better know how to make money from them. In my own research at Wharton, I've learned that most of the time, new business models come later after technologies have already come in, and first, we often see new technology like AI to improve productivity of already existing business models, and only later, we see that the new business models are emerging. To help me discuss this topic today in greater detail, I'm thrilled to introduce my first guest of the season. Alan Lee is a Fortune 500 CTO, currently at Analog Devices. Alan, welcome to Where AI Works.
It's great to be here, Sergey. Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about AI specifically, I wonder if you could share a little bit about yourself and your career path, your organizations, so listeners can learn a little bit more about you.
I'm a senior executive focused on leadership, innovation, finance, technology, and strategy. I've worked at a variety of corporations, IBM, Intel, AMD, most recently at ADI, in addition to a few startups. One of the things I'm most passionate about is really co-innovation, that simultaneous development of technology along with the business models to really achieve the maximum possible value.
Fantastic. Thank you, Alan. First, I would like to discuss how AI is transforming traditional business models. So ADI, for example, has a long history of producing, selling hardware, microchips. How do you think about AI challenging this old business model of selling hardware? And what new business models do you see evolving across multiple industry verticals that you have experience in?
Yeah, there's been a trend from the edge, but also certainly for mid-sized players in terms of automotive, also the core players, your larger AI, to move more from just selling the chips themselves towards a more integrated model that clearly includes software, algorithms, and other things. Now, different companies have, of course, done this in a variety of different ways, but the move is really more from companies selling components to selling integrated platforms that create solutions for customers, all the way up through creating systems or subsystems. So that has really been a trend, certainly in terms of the larger hardware suppliers that started maybe, say, 10 or 15 years ago. But it's really pervasive now and accelerating.
Interesting. How do you do this? Do you do this with customers? Do you do this with suppliers? Can you give us some examples of how this kind of a collaboration, co-innovation works in practice?
Yeah, it really needs to be done internally first. First of all, it has to have, particularly with traditional hardware companies, that understanding of the importance of software, the importance of firmware, the importance of algorithms. And once you start bringing these things together into a systemic whole, understanding and then working with the customers directly, not in the sense of, hey, we're producing something, but rather, how should we produce this platform or system that will actually create solutions for those customers? And I say you start internally first because you have to have some guideposts, some vision about what you might do. But so much of that, once you get that initially kicked off, is really about working directly with customers, looking across the supply chain to even your customers' customers, and finding ways that solutions can be brought about more efficiently or more cheaply.
So it sounds like this would change your entire relationship with OEMs and integrators. Does that sound right, or how does this happen?
Absolutely. And sometimes, of course, as one thinks of, say, verticalization or other things that are going on, there's natural tensions that occur there. But what I've seen more often than not in the AI arena, particularly as one moves from the core, by the core, I mean your larger AI, your large scale-out deployment platforms, to the edge, by which I mean things from the automobile, smaller things that are in handheld wearables, those types of things. I believe there's actually less tension occurring there. And because there's such a broad desire to increase the amount of intelligence as one moves out, I see really more of a willingness from customers that might, if you went through traditional verticalization, they might say, oh no, that's kind of our business, we do it. But in the AI space, I'm seeing more of a willingness to partner because I believe that artificial intelligence in many ways, pardon the cliche, but it's really increasing the pie, if you will. And they understand that. So they're more willing to say, okay, I'm willing to give up a few things here, but to have a much larger market, to bring in far more customers or a much higher value add.
Would you say that customers are responding positively to this idea of embedding intelligence at the edge rather than relying solely on something that sits somewhere in the cloud?
It's very early days. People aren't used to it yet. We saw some early misses, even, of course, on the larger scale AI side from some major companies. And as we move to the edge, it's going to be a trial by learning process. But for those that have gotten it right, and we've seen some huge successes, say in robotics and factories, in automotive, driving cars and safety features, that people are very much embracing it because they're not just seeing, hey, we're doing things a little bit better. They're seeing capabilities and solutions that were never possible before. And that excites anyone across the world.
It sounds like companies that used to sell hardware and make money that way are moving increasingly to business models which sell integrated systems, subsystems, which are designed with AI at the edge, which allows you to deploy smaller maybe AI models, which take data from Internet of Things kind of devices and allow you to do things that you couldn't do before.
Absolutely. I usually use an eighth grade earth science model to describe this. In the center, you have the core, and that's the large scale, you know, scale out massive AI systems. In between, you have the mantle, and you could think of this as industrial AI or AI for automotive, where you have enough compute power there. It's not a supercomputer, but enough compute power to do some really viable AI. And then at the edge, you have sensors, where you have phones. You have not as much compute power, usually small form factor, but you can indeed do some intelligence there. You can do some basic language work. You can do some basic prediction work there. And if nothing else, you can do some basic data analysis to decide the bottleneck in most modern machines isn't the computing, it's actually the memory. So what do you actually transmit? What do you actually store? And it's not that one of these will be dominant over the other in the end, although the core certainly dominates now, is that what we need and what we will achieve is a world where this artificial intelligence will have the right intelligence at the right place at the right time. And that's when we'll really be starting to extract full value from these complex systems.
I really like this mental model of mantle versus kind of the edge intelligence, and that at the end of the day, we will have to have intelligence throughout those layers, and that not every query has to go to ChatGPT or OpenAI or whatever it is, right? Some of the compute you can do just at the edge, and your thermostat doesn't need to talk to ChatGPT and constantly pump data back and forth into the cloud. I want to move on and talk a little bit about your objectives in your work and potential obstacles on the road to implementation of AI in a big organization. So what do you see kind of as key challenges? How do you make AI work for a big company? Is it about your people? Is it about your customers? Is it about your processes?
It's a great question. I think we finally reached the point that when we actually consider people, and the number of people that are working at, say, modern tech firms, about half of the people either grew up with or are fairly familiar with AI, and about half are not. It was something that's new to them. Now, many of those have, of course, done some upskilling and some other work. But right now, what I'm seeing is more of a cultural conflict in the sense of what does it mean to be a modern technology firm? There's the group that says, we don't need artificial intelligence. Human intelligence was good enough for us, and we can build these technologies. And there's the group that grew up using AI for the most part, and they've seen firsthand the value, whether that was in school or whether they developed some of these basic skills working with their colleagues early on. And I think as we move ahead, that cultural element, certainly over the course of the next few years, shouldn't be neglected. Everyone understands these days that big data is big, right? It's growing and we see all these exponential graphs, et cetera. But we need to think the same way of how do we get overall entire corporations bought in to AI models and how they're used and the models of, yes, some things are very large, some things are medium-sized, some things are very small. And what is the best use of AI for a particular application at the time? There's still plenty, you know, of hype going on about things that AI can do. And I also think there's underestimations by a fair number of people, particularly senior leaders, that they've heard about the hype and they're worried about it. And they've seen many deployments that have failed for a variety of reasons. And so they're not as willing to place large-term investments. And this could place some of these firms at risk because they're not going to be on the leading edge when the tides eventually turn. And as we move through the next few years of graduation and things, their body of engineers and body of scientific employees really has that as a basis or foundation, which is only naturally going to lead to more and more efficiencies in AI, much higher understandings, and in turn, much more value extracted from the technology.
How do you think about upskilling employees? What is the most effective approach to that?
That's a tough question. It's really about balance. What you need to do is you think of not just upskilling, but rolling out an AI program of some sort, is to understand that, yes, it is fantastic to have some of these lofty goals, and you must indeed invest in those lofty goals and what supports them, things like IT infrastructure, things like making sure you have the right data and the quality of data that you need to back it, but also provide some early wins and tie in and have a very high level of communication on both sides of the fence, both those that are pro and those that say, yes, we see some value, but not the value that's going to cause us to invest, say, X amount of dollars in this. They see it as a fool's errand. Call them the AI skeptics, if you will. And I think that, you know, gradual iteration of the shorter term, investing in the longer term, and then doing things in between will eventually get us where we want to be. Companies that I've seen that just try to do things that are small, they don't see the value in it. And those companies that I've seen that only want to invest and push all their chips into the table before the company's ready for it, I've seen a huge allergic reaction, if you will, in some cases that causes people to pull back and say, well, that didn't work, so we're not going to use it. And I don't think either of those approaches really work. So achieving that balance between the two, I believe, is critical.
So thinking about this balance between internal units, right? So obviously you're a CTO, you have more advanced users, probably fewer AI skeptics on your team. How do you work with business units on developing your AI applications, developing new business models? Because those other units might have lots of skeptics, right?
Yeah. It's surprising. It's actually, from my personal experience, been the opposite. The technologists who believe that they understand technology and the way that the world is and it will continue going on that way often are some of the largest skeptics, seeing more pushback. Whereas those, for instance, I've seen in the legal profession, those in HR, those in finance, they're honestly dying to get their hands on the new technology and more willing to explore because they don't have the technical doubts around it. It's the old science fiction aphorism, any sufficiently advanced technology appears like magic. And it is in many cases magical to them. It can truly change the way that they're doing things. So I've seen in many cases more pull from, say, the SG&A functions than I have seen on the technology side, where they believe, no, we'll just keep making this 3% better every year and that will get us where we need to be.
Interesting. That's unexpected to me. So when it comes to reworking internal processes, is there some change that you have made that had the biggest impact so far to help adopt this AI forward thinking?
You need to make it a part of people's actual workflow in the organization itself. If you make it something separate, then you'll have very low adoption. And already it's hard to measure productivity in this area, mainly because, as with many of these new technologies, you're not going to ask somebody, say, a programmer. They're asking something to do it, and they do it with AI, and they do it certain well. But you're not going to ask them, okay, now go and redo that entire software program without AI. And so that makes, in some cases, metrics hard to come by, at least some of the harder metrics. But you can do it in aggregate. So if you only do some of these small experiments and things, and yes, of course, you should start with some small experiments. But if you're not willing to dive in some areas and provide at least bit by bit the large scale training and make it a part of the actual workflow, people won't use it. We've seen this a lot in terms of basic engineering tools at the companies I've worked with. If you say, okay, well, you can use your standard engineering tool, which you've been using for 15 or 20 years, or you can use this new thing, people tend to gravitate towards what they know. But if you turn off the old thing for a bit and you say, hey, why don't you try using this? People are up in arms for about 2 or 3 weeks. But once they see the value in it, once they see the possibility, they'll turn around and they will be your biggest supporters.
I want to move on and talk about the future a little bit. So what do you see around the corner? What do you think AI will do to alter your products that you offer? How do you think about future development of AI? Where will it focus?
I really see, as we move ahead over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, a world of pervasive AI, where intelligence, machine intelligence of some sort, will exist everywhere, in our cars, in our homes, in our regular systems, in our schools, in the way that we interact with our media, our phones, etc. Maybe it helps you make a better selection of tomatoes at a supermarket, say, or something like that. As we move towards more autonomous driving and things, as we move towards more efficient robotics in warehouses, in factories, and that's going to increase efficiency, which will in turn increase the amount of AI and things that we use. And of course, something that's already present today and very much at the top of people's minds, the very large scale AI. Trying to move towards, in some sense, general artificial intelligence, right? That idea of sentience, that idea of truly thinking and what that can mean. And to me, the future is about what is the balance between these things? What does that spectrum look like? Where do we need more intelligence? How is this going to help humankind get rid of more medium tasks? But just as importantly, what are the people that are doing, for instance, more menial tasks? What is their next role as the world evolves? And how do we bring society forward? So I see both real beauty and real possibility in what we can do, but I also see real areas of caution where we need to think and bring people along.
What do you see in this space evolving as a kind of a business model? Do you charge per use of AI? Do you charge per money that AI makes for you somehow? Do you charge something for data?
We've seen a lot of missteps here, right? We've seen a lot of people say, because theoretically, AI is great to solve a huge number of the world's problems, but not many of those have actually come to pass yet. So I think it's important to get over that hill or to have the activation energy to look first internally, as I mentioned before, and get more of those folks involved and engaged. Because when you do, that's when you'll start seeing that interaction at the large scale corporate levels about, hey, what does the solution really mean? What AI is enabling us to do is to think about the world and interact with the world in brand new ways. It hasn't created, you know, the old jokes. I mean, you're dealing in a business school about, oh, well, this is a new business or a new way of doing business. No, in essence, you buy low, you sell high in any particular order, right? You know, that you can. But what you're doing is looking at solutions from a different perspective. And I think that by co-developing these new technology along with new business models, we're not going to change the buy low, sell high portions of the business. But we will see new models about how we monetize, particularly as we move AI forward. We've seen some of those, for instance, let's take subscription models. First of all, subscription models were the rage. And lately, if you follow a lot of the commercials on TV, you'll see a lot of business models that are based on actually getting rid of your subscription models that you're paying for because you're not actually using them. And, you know, I've seen things that are creative, such as AI could go through and maybe attenuate that somewhat, right? And say, okay, well, we'll keep you on some kind of basic maintenance plan so you're not paying as much. People say, oh, wow, that's great. This company I'm using is looking out for me. When I need it, it'll be there. I'll have it available. So I'm seeing a lot more areas that used to be black and white that are a lot more nuanced that I think are really ripe for the picking in terms of AI, which if you had to make a decision early on and you didn't have any of that feedback, you would have to make a digital decision, yes or no, zero or one. But adding AI into the mix, along with, of course, big data, large computation, and AI at the edge, it really is going to enable a more nuanced understanding of where and when we can charge customers and where do they see value and how can we monetize and capitalize on that. And the other part of that model, you know, they say the customer is always right, and they still are. But now we're in an era in particular where innovation is king. And understanding what is the art of the possible and what the customer can possibly have. It's, again, that balance as we bring things forward.
Finally, I want to ask you just for your kind of a top AI-related recommendation or advice to business leaders who are listening to this podcast.
I would say it comes back to balance, the yin and the yang of AI, particularly at this particular time in human history and where AI stands. It's such a new technology to some, and it's such a powerful technology that applying some balance, being both cautious about how you apply it, but also willing to invest heavily when you see a true and viable market where you can capitalize on it, that's where I really see the huge value and the best advice that I can give business leaders right now.
Fantastic. What a great way to kick off season 2 of the podcast. We've covered a lot of ground today. Alan, thank you for sharing your time with us here on Where AI Works.
Thank you for having me, Sergey. It was a real pleasure to be here and speak with you today.
Let me now review a few key takeaways from my conversation with Alan. So there are so many, it's a little hard to summarize them all, but as I teach a program on business model innovation in the age of AI at Wharton, and I hear from many executives that struggle with AI implementation in their companies, we see here there are actually many ways to monetize AI. Some of it just comes from demand. Your customers demand AI from hardware manufacturers, and increasingly hardware manufacturers are moving into subsystem manufacturing, which is combined with AI in some way. And the whole kind of a creation of ecosystems where hardware interacts with AI. Other monetizations may involve AI for internal efficiency, driving internal processes within the organization. And yet another monetization could come from external optimization, connecting better with customers, learning about customers' needs through AI, and the new business model can come out of that. But overall, we both believe in pervasiveness of AI. It will be everywhere, which is why we need balance right now. We need to be careful and cautious about investing in AI and experimenting with AI. It always starts with experiment, as I teach in my classes. At the same time, you need to invest decisively. You need to invest heavily.
Yeah, start with multiple small experiments, see what works. But if you're playing Texas Hold'em, there comes a time when you need to push your chips into the center of the table.
That's a great way to summarize this, Alan. That brings us to the end of our season premiere. Thanks so much for listening. Please follow us so you don't miss an episode. And be sure to tune in next time when I'm speaking with Elad Valach, the CEO of ADOC, a trailblazer in clinical AI applications. This has been Where AI Works, conversations at the intersection of AI and industry, brought to you by Wharton in collaboration with Accenture. I am Sergey Netesin. Bye for now.